I kind of turned Aaron on to the fellow that took the shots of the New York Dolls.
Oh yeah, Dan McNeil. Yes.
Yeah.
Dan McNeil, who had the New York Dolls shots, and he just went and he doesn't even have the negatives anymore. He just has those faded sort of Kodachrome prints.
Yeah, that was those are really great shots. I mean, just so early and.
The show was pretty, and to hear the stories about the show, you know, from people like Bocchieri, who was there, and seeing the New York Dolls, even if they were pretty ramshackle that night, at that tender age, no doubt had an effect on them.
Oh yeah, those photos are just priceless.
And Rob, for the posters that you gave for the book, because like again, every page here is like courtesy Neptune Records.
Oh
courtesy.
God, yeah,
it's awesome. For the posters that you gave, are those posters all collected one by one? Because those did not come from the dumpster, did they?
Sorry, I'm getting like every third word here over this thing, so I missed that.
Oh, I was just going to say, the posters that are in the book, Rob, we're speaking to Rob from Neptune Records, who supplied a lot of stuff for this amazing book, Live at the Commodore, by Aaron Chapman, who's live here in the Nardwuar Human Surveyor radio show. And we'll reward you, listeners, for listening to this show if you keep listening. The posters you supplied, did you collect those one by one? Those did not come from the dumpster, did they?
No, they didn't come from the dumpster. In fact, I don't think I got any posters from the dumpster. I've just collected posters since I was a kid, basically, in the 60s. And I was always into art. So when I saw these, like the psychedelic posters, which really sort of got me into it, I just fell in love with it. And I just started grabbing them when I saw them on poles and stuff in Burnaby, where I grew up, and just started collecting. And I've collected pretty much all the Commodore stuff just along the way, and of course everything else in between all the different venues.
So yeah, amazing collection of stuff.
What's there left for Aaron to do now, next? What's the next book there, Rob?
Aaron should either do The Cave or all my posters.
Yeah, that's a good idea, yeah.
Is there anything left to do, Rob? Is there anything left of Vancouver to do? Do you think a cave history would be good? I mean, because we've got the penthouse, we've got the Commodore.
Well, maybe a book with, maybe 10 different venues or something, and do an in-depth thing of each one.
That's,
I don't know. Aaron's probably got a better idea. He's the writer.
that's certainly been talked about and whatnot. There's a couple of irons in the fire I have for something next, but I might do something completely different as well. I did a piece in a book called Vancouver Confidential that came out earlier this year about what Vancouver was like in the Second World War, that got into a little bit of military history. So I may do something along those lines, as a bit of something different. But the idea, there's lots of, the one thing is there's an amazing amount of books that have come out in the last couple of years that spotlight Vancouver history. And, Vancouver Noir is one of them. Daniel Francis's books, the late Chuck Davis, his stuff, and a whole cadre of people from Michael Kluckner and John Atkin, the real sort of longtime heroes of the Vancouver history scene, to newer people like myself and Jesse Donaldson and Jason Vanderhill and Eve Lazarus. A bunch of these people who are all putting out books. So I'm surprised no one said there hasn't been a literary movement of some of the stuff going on, because some of the stuff sells very well in bookstores. There's a real appetite for it, and there's a tremendous amount of stories in Vancouver that no one's touched on yet. So there's lots of material out there still to cover.
Well, thanks for phoning in, Rob. Really appreciate it. Anything else you want to say about the book Live at the Commodore, Rob, at all, and about Aaron's book?
It is available at Neptune Records for sale.
We have it there for sale as well, but it is a great book. I collect books. I have a lot of books, and it's a wonderful read. There was all kinds of stuff I didn't know, and things I'd forgotten about that I was reminded when I went through it. And again, it's there's other posters, not just mine, in there that were great to see as well, and photos. Like, those great photographers have really captured a lot of stuff, well, everywhere, but at the Commodore in particular. But it's a great book, and I was happy to help contribute to it.
Yeah, and I can't thank Rob enough for his generosity in having not only and the presence of mind, or just the pack rat sensibility to hold on to all this stuff, which is half the battle and whatnot.
And we're going to end the show right now with the Pixies live from 1992 at the Commodore, Rob, from your collection.
Yeah, it's it's again, there's a it's great that the fellow I know tapes all these things. I ended up actually selling the Nirvana one live from the Commodore to Nirvana. I brokered it between the guy that taped it and Nirvana.
And I know the guy who Rob is talking about too, and he has tons more of these tapes and discs. He gave me the Pogues at the Commodore with Joe Strummer singing, which is it's a great record just to put on as a party album and whatnot. And it'd be nice to see this stuff sort of see the light of day without anybody getting any trouble for it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, they just haven't done the Nirvana one. They haven't actually put it out, even though I sold it to them. It's an unbelievable quality.
Yeah, yeah, amazing.
Well, thanks so much, Rob, and doot-doot-a-loot-doo.
Doot-doot.
And you're still listening to the Nardwater Human Spirit Radio Show. Thank you so much for coming in.
Hey, thanks, A.O. Chapman. Great to see you again.
Live at the Commodore. And to reward, thank you for coming in. And to reward the listeners, you've brought a copy of the book to give away to a lucky caller.
Yeah.
604-822-2487. We'll take the second caller. 604-822-2487. 604-UBCCITR. And you win a free copy of the book live at the Commodore. You have to come down to CITR business office like 10 to 5 Monday to Friday to pick it up. So we'll put your name at the door of the CITR business office. You can win this book live at the Commodore. And if you don't win the book, what happens if you don't win the book?
If you don't win the book, you can get it at all the bookstores in town, Black Bond Books, Book Warehouse, Chapters, Pulp Fiction, and record stores like Neptune Records and whatnot also have it. So it's showing up everywhere. So just call down to your favorite store.
And you're going to hook me up with Don Rickles?
Oh, man, when he comes to town again, we got to go see him again.
Because I've tried so hard to get hooked up with Don Rickles. I had no luck.
I see him every time he comes to town, and I go back and we talk. Now. He signed something for me last time, which he saw him. He said... what did it say? He signed it. Aaron, next time I'm in town, let's hang out. Maybe. Don. Terrific.
Ba-boom. Well, thank you again, Aaron Chapman, for coming out to Another Word of Human Spirit Radio Show. 604-822-2487. 604-UBCCATR. If you want to win a copy of Live at the Commodore. And here, courtesy Rob Frith and Aaron Chapman and a mysterious source, is an excerpt as much as we can of the Pixies Live at the Commodore from 1992. Why should people care about the Commodore? Why should people care?
It's it's one of the great sort of concert halls that is left in North America, and it's largely recognized, certainly in town, as one of the best of them. But even across Canada, there's really nothing like it, and maybe across North America, there's nothing like it either.
Well, thanks so much, Aaron. Keep on rocking in the free world, and doot doot a loot doo.
Doot doot.
Sorry about the sunglasses, a little something I picked up. Her head is in a better way. Her pants on fire. She's just looking for the perfect way. It's her brain's desire. Yeah!
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
And I'm Alberto Montilla. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia. To our UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:13 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent, campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are an interview with UBC Professor Maxwell Cameron, Director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions.
Later in the program, a report from Konstantin Prodanovic, who is currently attending the vigil for Michael Brown at the Martha Piper Plaza. And a roundtable discussion about civil disobedience in today's social landscape, specifically in relation to the Burnaby Mountain protests. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC dentistry professor to receive top military honor. Today, General Thomas Lawson, Canada's Chief of Defense Staff, presented University of British Columbia dentistry professor David Sweet with a medal for distinguished service. Professor Sweet is an expert in the field of forensic odontology, which is the science of victim identification using teeth and dental charts. Professor Sweet's expertise was relied upon during the investigation of serial killer Robert Picton, and he led the team of Canadian forensic experts into the gruesome aftermath of Thailand's recent and devastating tsunami. Though his work often takes him into scenes of mass casualties, Professor Sweet focuses on the impact of the work of the living. Quote, "Responders that identify positively the bodies of found persons can provide much-needed answers for awaiting loved ones. We can make things better for families searching for news and information." In 2008, he received the Order of Canada for his expert involvement in the Picton case. Today's Medal for Distinguished Service is the result of his contributions to the field of forensic odontology, where the techniques and protocols developed by him and his colleagues at the UBC's Bureau of Legal Dentistry have become widespread theater war practices for the Canadian, United States, and other NATO militaries around the world. Professor Sweet attributed part of his success to the other BC team members and added that he is, quote, "truly humbled by this honor."
In local news, BC Premier Christy Clark criticizes private sector's boardroom diversity. Christy Clark recently called for businesses to increase the number of women on their boards. However, she does not plan to adopt the standards held by 7 other provinces, which require businesses to make their inclusion policies explicit. Clark said, quote, "If you want to make a difference, you have to ask people to do things that are going to be really effective. I would be reticent about wanting to impose red tape on companies when we don't know if it is going to render us the outcome we want." Women account for just 6.6% of board members of the top 100 companies based in BC. Clark said that her government would like to see at least a third of members on publicly appointed boards be women. However, there is currently no framework in place to achieve this goal. Adrian Dix, an NDP MLA, called Clark out saying that, quote, "even the Harper government is more progressive than the Clark government on this." That's how out of touch the premier is on that question.
As many listeners may know, today is Black Friday. However, today is also Buy Nothing Day, a campaign created by the Vancouver anti-consumerism magazine Adbusters. Senior editor Doug Haddow, in an interview with CBC's The Early Edition, said, quote, "We're trying to challenge a broken system. We're trying to attack consumerism at its heart." Adbusters started by Buy Nothing Day 20 years ago, purposely timing it to coincide with the Black Friday. Haddow said, quote, "I've been quite horrified to see the same violent, chaotic incidents we're used to seeing in the States be replicated throughout England and South America, and soon enough, maybe Canada. Hopefully we have a bit more dignity." The International Buy Nothing Day begins tomorrow and is recognized in 60 different countries.
Richmond City Hall is currently dealing with a proposal for a pipeline which would carry jet fuel to Vancouver International Airport. The fuel would be brought in by barges and large tankers the size of 3 football fields long along the Fraser River and stored in a tank farm on the north shore of the southern arm of the river. The project was proposed by the Vancouver Airport Fuel Facilities Corporation, a non-for-profit company owned by a group of commercial airlines, including most of the domestic and international carriers who fly out of Vancouver International Airport. In December of last year, the provincial government issued an environmental assessment certificate to the company, which would allow the project construction to proceed. However, the Vancouver Airport Fuel Project Opposition for Richmond filed a petition to the BC Supreme Court requesting a judicial review of the certificate. The court had held hearings on the Wednesday and Thursday from this group. In an interview a couple of days before these hearings, City Councillor Derek Dang said, quote, "We've tried very hard to talk with our provincial counterparts and our federal people to see if we can get them to, you know, take some responsibility on the areas that they represent and say, hey, listen, you know, maybe this isn't the best interest of the community." In a meeting on November 17th, Richmond City Council passed a resolution reaffirming its opposition to the project.
In national news, the federal government's Veteran Fund, not what it seems. The conservative federal government has newly committed $200 million in funds to help recovering veterans with mental health issues. However, the government has shied away from detailing the plan for the funds in long term. And very long term at that. The $200 million is due to be shelled out over the next half century. The funding boost was announced only days before the Auditor General released a scathing report, noting that veterans are waiting months, sometimes years, to access their disability benefits. From an observer perspective, the funding boost could be a tactic on the part of the Conservatives to appease the public, while they do little to repair their existing relationship with veterans in Canada.
In international news, marches in Mexico continue. President announces anti-crime plan. President Enrique Peña Nieto's announcement comes as part of a new offensive against corruption within Mexico's government. This plan would allow Congress to dissolve local governments where drug cartels have taken hold. The anti-crime plan is meant to dissipate the complex layers of bureaucracy between the federal, state, and local governments. The president claims that the plan was influenced by the disappearance of 43 teachers and college students from the town of Iguala. The missing persons were allegedly killed by drug cartels working in collaboration with local police. Numerous protests and marches have followed the discovery of this tragedy. To make matters worse, another 11 bodies have been found incinerated at the side of the road outside of Guerrero City. The anti-crime plan will enable local police to play a greater role in combating the drug cartels prominent within Mexico's most troubled states. However, Mexico-based security analyst Alejandro Hope is skeptical of the plan's success, saying that it is only another addition to a long line of poorly implemented anti-crime plans. Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Right to Play is an international humanitarian organization using sport and play programs to encourage the healthy physical, social, and emotional development of the world's most disadvantaged children. RTP at UBC is run by a team of committed university students who advocate sport for development, and it is the first university chapter of its kind. We want you to get involved. Together, we can educate students about sport for development, help raise money, and teach children here in the Lower Mainland about the importance of sport and a healthy lifestyle. So check us out at www.interchange.ubc.ca/RTPUBC.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have news correspondent Emily Blake's interview with UBC political science professor Maxwell Cameron, director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, about voter turnout. In the recent Vancouver municipal election, 44% of eligible voters cast a ballot, a 10% increase from 2011.
At the most recent Vancouver municipal election, voter turnout increased by 10%. What were some of the factors involved in this?
I think there were at least three factors. One was that we had advance polls available for many days and in many locations, and that meant a lot of people could vote before the elections, and I think about twice the number of people voted in advance polls this time as did in the last. Many of those people would have been activists of the parties, and by voting early, they were then able to spend election day pulling the vote, manning the telephone banks, and going door-to-door and giving people rides and that sort of thing. And so the second thing is that having such a tight race where you have a couple of candidates that are seemingly neck and neck in the polls encourages people to turn out, to take an interest in the race and the hard-hitting, hard-fought campaign, and that generated a certain amount of media attention. And of course, it's always good to have good weather on election day, so that would be another contributing factor. A nice sunny day, and there were long lines, and there was a bit of disruption because you could vote anywhere in Vancouver, and so it was a little bit hard for the election officials to know how many ballots to give to each polling station. And that created a bit of difficulty, but overall it was a good thing. An increase in voter turnout was quite substantial.
Now, 44% voter turnout is still relatively low. What are some reasons for low voter turnout, especially in Canada?
Yeah, it's lower at the municipal level than it tends to be at the federal and provincial levels. So 44% is not bad for municipal elections. One has to go back more than a decade to find another election where we had that kind of voter turnout. But you're right, it's still well below half of the eligible population. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. But one of them is that our cities are primarily, they're not really, you know, constitutionally established levels of government. They're creatures of the provinces. Provinces create and can amalgamate or can disband cities. They don't have a lot of powers. They don't have big budgets. They're largely sort of responsible for things like sewage and garbage collection. As a consequence of that, the sort of things that cities do, decisions around zoning, decisions around bike lane or density, property development, and so forth, these tend to generate a lot of agitation among those who are directly affected. But if you're not directly affected, you tend to sort of just assume that the municipal services will be there. And so the fact that there's such a tendency to kind of what some people call NIMBYism, the sort of the not in my backyard mentality, means that you don't get people turning out to vote because they are thinking so much in terms of the broader philosophical differences represented by the parties or the future of their locale. they're motivated by things that are more particularistic. That being said, we do see in the big cities the emergence of something that looks more like a party system. So if people are strong New Democrats or strong liberals, they might identify with Vision or the NPA. And we've also seen broader issues bleed into municipal politics, whether it's pipelines or Chevron in the schools and other issues like that, that really kind of pick up on people's concern about things like growing corporate power, environmental issues, and issues of that nature.
So what are some ways to increase voter turnout, especially in the youth population?
Certainly the youth population is the population that's least likely to vote, and people roughly from 18 to 24 tend by and large to vote very little, and it's a big concern because if you don't vote when you're young, you're less likely to vote when you're middle-aged or older. So we want to see youth turnout increase. I think one of the reasons is that a lot of young people, rightly or wrongly, feel that democratic elections are not necessarily the way that they can have the most impact. A lot of young people seek to have an impact in other kinds of ways. How do you promote greater youth turnout? Well, there are a number of things that we can do. I mean, just practically speaking, certainly having things like civics education involving simulations of model parliaments in high schools, that's been done in BC and in Ontario and other places. And we know that if you involve students early, and particularly if you can get them using social media to think and act around politics, that can help people. But I also think that it's necessary to start looking at ways that we make our cities more inviting and to connect with young people and their concerns more adequately. Part of the problem with local government is we don't have good forms of public engagement. You know, public consultations, for example, around permits for development are just not really very convincing ways of showing that we care about what our citizens think about what's going on in City Hall. So we need to look at new and more creative ways of engaging the public. Using social media, I think, is one solution, but also participatory budgeting, citizens' assemblies. There are a host of democratic innovations that we see all around the world. Many of these innovations come out of the municipal level of government. They come from Porto Alegre in Brazil. The citizens' assembly idea actually germinated first here in British Columbia around electoral reform. And so I think that if we wanted to, if our political system wanted to engage young people more, there are ways of doing that. I think part of the problem is that it just hasn't been enough of a focus on it. The reality is if young people don't vote, they have less influence, and if you have less influence, people will spend less time worrying about how to address your concerns.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Happy to do it.
Thank you, Emily, for that. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Sophomore album Loungewear from the Portland duo Mel Brewers brings together the Zulu rhythms of Dionysian New Orleans street folk with the kinetic dub bluegrass of New York nerdcore. However, this decrepit rehash only tortures the nubile freshness of their debut, the Whack Jite Travelogues. This can only be seen as the decline of a nascent career before it has even begun to incline, and receives their lowest score yet, 7.4 Radioheads out of 10 Arcade Fires.
Want an alternative to music blogs? Discorder Magazine has been supporting Vancouver's independent music community for over 30 years. Come help keep local music journalism alive at the Discorder fundraiser and launch party this December 4th, featuring Rec Center, Skinny Kids, Other Jesus, and CITR's very own DJ Pop Tours. Doors are at 8, with $5 cover before 10 and $10 after. It's happening this Thursday, December 4th, at the Hindenburg, 23 West Cordova. December's best new fundraiser, as selected by Discorder editors.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
And this is Morgan Gee. I am in the studio with Konstantin Prodanovich.
Hello, everybody.
He was just up at the Martha Piper Plaza, checking out the vigil that's being held for Michael Brown. Konstantin, can you tell me a little bit about what's going on up there right now?
Yeah, there's about 200 students gathered there right now. It's really quiet, respectful, somber. I honestly wasn't there for very long, considering that it started about 15 minutes late. But the impression that I got was that it was very directed at what had happened with Michael Brown specifically.
Was there very much discussion going on, or was it just a collection of students?
There was a lot of discussion. In fact, it's interesting that the discussion around the Michael Brown vigil was framed a lot about police violence in general, as opposed to just the Michael Brown case. So I found that really refreshing.
Okay, yeah, because I know, like, in the news in the last couple of days, there's been a lot of stories about police violence both in Canada and the U.S. What do you think the efficacy of having this kind of vigil is?
I think if we have these kind of conversations going around the Michael Brown vigil, where we're actually talking about in a larger context of systemic police violence, I think then it's really effective to actually get people having conversations about this kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on right now, like you said. There was a man recently shot in Vancouver on 49th and Knight,
mm-hmm.
By police. There's been the Burnaby Mountain protests, where police were trying to enforce a injunction that was deemed illegal. So you're right. This as long as we're talking about it in the larger context of systemic police violence, I think it's really effective.
So how long is? Do you know how long the vigil is going on for? If there's listeners who are interested in attending?
So the vigil is supposed to go on until about 6 p.m. tonight. They started a little late, like I said, so I'm guessing it'll go on a little bit longer. It looked like there was quite a few speeches planned. So if there's any listeners that do want to get up there, it's at Martha Piper Plaza here at UBC. If you just keep walking past that big metallic UBC sign all the way up the hill to the fountain, that's where you'll find them gathered.
And while you were there, were there any speakers?
There were. There was a couple social justice groups that were getting in line to speak. They had just began speaking when I had to come back down here into the nice warm studio.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Costa.
Very welcome.
And we'll be right back with more of Costa. Actually, we're having a roundtable with Maya Graves, Ty Grauman, myself.
That'll be a nice transition.
And a few other students who are interested in the topic of civil disobedience, the Burnaby Mountain protests. So we'll be right back after a very short PSA break.
An ocean of sound and echoes abound. It's Saturday night, so chill, and don't go out until your ears have heard a neater, deeper reverb. Bringing you the newest tracks and old favorites of shoegaze, post-rock, trip-hop, dream-pop, and everything in between with the Sick Echo. Enter into a deeper reverb every Saturday night from 8 to 9 p.m. on CITR.
Soundtrack to your life, perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV. My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Yeah, come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down.
Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, in Vancouver or online at CITR.ca. Welcome back.
This is Morgan again, and we've got Costa, Maya, Ty, and Rohit here in the studios.
Full house, guys.
So we're gonna have a panel discussion. Well, I guess not really a panel; it's more of a roundtable discussion on what's been going on with the Burnaby Mountain protests, and all the civil disobedience that's been happening, and whether people think that has been effective, how our opinions and views of social justice movements and civil disobedience have changed over the last 20 years or so. I guess we'll just start with do you guys think that civil disobedience is effective? I guess we'll start there. Maya, do you want to?
Yeah, I think particularly in the case of Burnaby Mountain, it's been very effective. Kinder Morgan knows that without an injunction, they would not be able to do work without interference from the public. And now that the injunction has been revoked, Kinder Morgan is actually now leaving the site and packing up everything. So I think that's huge. And I think it's also important to note that the city of Burnaby, municipalities of North Vancouver, Victoria, and several others who are going to be affected by pipeline expansion have all been opposed to the pipeline. They requested that the National Energy Board hold public hearings where they could voice their opinions, but the National Energy Board refused, and they just went in and did work, overriding City of Burnaby bylaws, which is an infringement, really, of our democratic rights. So we had no choice but to be civilly disobedient.
Anyone else want to jump in on that?
I think the protest was effective. The RCMP is also spending a lot of money keeping their police officers there, so I'm not sure if that had an input in the decision made in the BC Supreme Court. But I don't think we would have come to this conclusion without all that protest. So good job for anyone who went out and supported.
Mm-hmm. I think the methods have been really effective as well. I mean, you look at all the protesters, and for the most part, they've kept behind the injunction lines unless they have clearly wanted to get arrested. I think it's been a conscious decision on part of the protesters to actually go through with civil disobedience. It's been a really effective strategy, I find, and the media has done a really good job covering it. I know the Vancouver Observer has done a fantastic job with this story. They've been on top of it. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but that's where I've been getting a lot of my information personally. How has the media response been, at least from your guys' perspectives, to this issue?
I think the media response has been better than I expected. It's hard to say, really. I've actually been getting a lot of my information from social media, from Facebook groups of people actually there, like Kinder Morgan updates, Burnaby
right.
Mountain, something like that. I think that the more mainstream media is keen to put a positive slant on how the RCMP is acting in the situation. But from some of the footage that I've seen, I think the RCMP have been relatively respectful. I haven't seen anything that's been shocking so far.
Right.
I think social media has played a huge role in also informing people what's happening, because there's a huge page on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a First Nations page called Show Kinder Morgan Your Fish, and it's where the First Nations tribes in the area are actually posting pictures of the salmon they eat and how important it is to their culture. And so I think it's important to other people to be informed by that, and we are all on social media every day. It's become a huge activist in today's society. So I think that without that, some people who don't plug into the news or whatnot may not have known what's happening. And there's also a ton of really passionate videos going up. Like if you YouTube Kinder Morgan, you can see a bunch of speeches and some songs and everything. So mm-hmm. that's really cool too.
Do you think it's kept a lot of people involved that wouldn't have been otherwise, at least on these social media platforms? Do you think social media gets to a different demographic than, say, the mainstream news that would be covering this? I get the impression that that's what you've been saying.
Yeah, I know personally people I've been talking to around UBC have heard about it on UBC pages, and I mean, from what I understand, we're pretty far from Burnaby.
Right.
So that's what I think.
And I just want to jump in there, because Maya, the UBC SEC has been involved in trying to get students to go up to Burnaby Mountain. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So the Student Environment Center is a resource group here at UBC, and we like to fund sustainable activities around campus. And I think we were, for our vision for this year, we really wanted to kind of have more collaboration between different activist groups at UBC, because even though not all are environmental, we're all fighting for respect for life, and I think that's what this issue is really about at the crux of it. So we wanted to kind of gather all the UBC groups and UBC students together in one place this Sunday on Burnaby Mountain.
And what's the response been like to that call out?
It's been good. So far, I think just under 200 people attending on the Facebook event. Never can be sure how many people will actually attend. But the response has been positive. I think people were waiting for some sort of call. Okay, now is the time. Let's all go.
Do you think that the fact that Kinder Morgan has finished up on one of their sites, do you think that will impact student interest in actually heading up to the mountain?
Mm-hmm. This is definitely something I've been considering, because they are heading out on Monday. However, Sunday is International Day of Burnaby Mountain Solidarity. I'm reading online, people are saying it's really important to still keep citizen presence on the mountain. So I still think it's important for us to be there. Yeah.
I was just going to make a comment about, I don't know if you guys heard about this recent thing, this recent somewhat of a scandal that UBC sent out an email supposedly discouraging students from actually going to the protest initially. And then they had to fix that email up.
It was directed at international students.
International students particularly,
I think it was specifically from the forestry department, if I'm correct. So I think the context of the email was that international students, if they're arrested, even in a civil disobedience charge, they have the potential to be deported from the country. And I guess when you have an institutional voice coming in there and saying something like that, I think it
can be misconstrued, you think, or
I don't know if misconstrued is the right word.
Well, yeah, if you're meaning that that it might seem like the UBC as an institution is discouraging student activism or something,
there was a PR follow-up that said that litigation would actually have to come from the government itself, and that UBC didn't actually have a right to send out this email. And I think so it's been conflicting within the actual department and within the university itself. Just want to make it clear that it wasn't a conscious choice on behalf of the university administration to do something like this. I think it came out of the blue, and it's been debated even within the university itself.
So I'd like to swing back just to talking about the media coverage. Costa, you've said that you felt like it was pretty fair coverage. But Ty, earlier when we were talking about it, looking at the way that it's being covered from an Aboriginal perspective, there's been some issues with that, and I've noticed that as well. Would you care to talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, where they're trying to drill these pipelines on Burnaby Mountain is sacred First Nations territory. There has been a sacred fire burning there, which represents the fight for the land of the First Nations people. But only recently has their debate come into what I would see as news that the majority sees. It's really hard to find information on the media specifically about why this land is so important and what the First Nations tribes are going to lose. Like I said, there's the Facebook page for Salmon, but an elder, a grand chief, Stuart Phillips, was arrested yesterday. And that was well covered, and a bunch of First Nations elders marched through the line. But other than that, I don't think that we've personally, this is just my opinion, but I don't think we've heard enough about what they're going to lose and what their rights are to the land and how those aren't being respected. And Kinder Morgan has put out a couple statements saying that they respect the First Nations territory. But I think it would be interesting to dig deeper into that and find out what legalities the First Nations people have and Kinder Morgan has in opposition to that land. Because right now we know it's sacred First Nations land, but we don't know why.
Right. Well, and I understand that, I guess I pronounced her name, Sutlut. She was one of the few people who was actually allowed to legally cross over the police line earlier in the week, because it is traditional land. So I think there is some understanding
there in terms of recognizing their right to be on the land. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it definitely hasn't. It hasn't been. It's a tricky situation.
Yeah,
there's very few nations in Canada. Nisga may be the only one in BC, possibly in Canada, that actually has come to like a full agreement with the government over their lands. And do you feel like it's a little bit of a sticking point, just because it may be setting precedent if they do recognize that development can only occur with consent from First Nations? Because it happens all the time across Canada, and especially in BC right now, with development happening with either no consent or, you know, quote unquote consultation, but it still goes ahead.
Yeah, I think it could have precedent because if they still have legal ancestral rights to the land, then something else to consider is that the First Nations people won't just be losing sacred land, they also won't be benefiting from the Kinder Morgan pipeline economically. So even though it's their land, Kinder Morgan will receive most of the money from the pipeline, yeah, and the money the pipeline gets them, and also Edmonton, Alberta will receive a lot of the money. British Columbia is only going to receive 2%, and so I think that if those legalities were recognized with the First Nations people, then if the pipeline does pass, I think they are owed something as well.
Right. And just touching on a little bit about like the voices that have been heard throughout this period, how do you feel that Aboriginal voices were represented through the media?
They talk a lot about drumming, and there's been a lot of coverage about this sacred fire that's been burning the whole time, and was actually set by Sutlut, the elder.
Do you feel like there's been adequate coverage of other Aboriginal voices in mainstream media?
To be honest, no. I mean, we hear a lot about major chiefs and major speeches that are happening, but we don't hear about groups or tribes, mm-hmm, or ensembles of First Nations people and what they're doing to protest against.
There hasn't even been a lot of coverage about a lot of groups around BC have come out in solidarity, but a lot of groups even across the border have come out in solidarity with the First Nations groups up on Burnaby Mountain. I think that's important too. You're right that there hasn't been a lot of coverage about these external groups that are coming out all across the country. It's even been talked about within the context of the Idle No More movement, which is an ongoing movement of First Nations groups. So I think you're right that we don't hear enough about this, and we don't hear enough about the larger groups in general that are coming out against this.
And I guess moving away from media coverage now, I'm curious to know what you guys think about people being arrested for this. I know that most of the arrests people have been released. It's been proven, you know, these are not they're not sticking. But do you feel like that being arrested for this for civil disobedience has become sort of glorified by the media, and whether that's impacting the public's perception of the police and the relationship between the police and the public?
I don't know how much it's being glorified by the mainstream media. I normally just see it as numbers, like over 100 people have been arrested crossing the police line. But I think in general conversation around the issue, I think that the people who are being arrested are definitely appreciated for what they're doing. And I think this is really interesting. I think it's a good thing that what a definition of a successful person or activist is being is someone who's really willing to stand up what they believe in and not necessarily obey what is strictly in place.
I think we have to keep in mind, too, that there's a lot of privilege in the fact that you can willingly get arrested with the idea in your head, or with the knowledge that you are going to peacefully be released in the future, which has been the case with a lot of these arrests. I think that some activists have done an incredible job addressing the fact that there is a lot of people who don't have this privilege, especially people of color or of First Nations descent in the Lower Mainland, in Vancouver who get arrested all the time on frivolous charges and don't have the benefit of this. So right. I think in part, this move to get arrested also is a motion of solidarity towards that cause as well.
I was just going to say that I think probably the closest thing to glorification of being arrested has been in the social media conversations. And I think Maya was kind of hinting at that the mainstream media obviously won't be glorifying arrest. But even when CBC posts the latest arrest numbers or a prominent figure who has been arrested, like, for example, David Suzuki's son, grandson who got arrested and then made a really incredible speech. That's when you start to see like the comments and the public perception, and that's when you largely, if you just look at these Facebook comments about the arrest, that it does seem to be in solidarity with the movement, with the protests.
And then, so I guess like the second part of that question then, do you guys? I have conflicting feelings about, like, you know, willfully being arrested, just because I feel like in doing that, it really puts the police in a very negative light, and that there's always a lot of conflict when police have to be put in that position of upholding the law. So I'm just wondering, like, what you guys think about civil disobedience and being willfully arrested and knowing that you're going to be released and how that impacts the way people perceive the police and their role in society. Any takers?
Sorry, can you repeat the end part of the question?
Okay. So just like whether you think, or in what ways civil disobedience, does it impact, yeah, like whether people perceive the police as having a different role in society?
Yeah, I mean, I think from what I've been reading online, certainly from a non-Indigenous perspective, there's been a lot of saying, you know, we should respect the police. They're, you know, they may not necessarily agree with us what's happening. They're just upholding their duty, whatever. And the CTV article I read about the Grand Chief said, you know, the police actually held up the tape for him to cross under and held his hand. And I looked at the footage and he didn't really hold up the tape, but whatever. I don't think the police in this situation have been bad, but I think given the light of recent events where we're hearing about so much ridiculous incidents of police violence and abuses of power, that I think that is definitely playing into the situation where, like, I'm reading all the time on social media, like, why should we respect authority? And I think that's definitely bleeding into this movement.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just with the context of recent events, not only in Canada, but across the world, really. It's hard to say that police authority is respected or honored in the same way as it once was. And that's an unavoidable fact in this kind of discussion, especially when if it's like a situation like this, when environmental issues and Indigenous rights are seen as being the primary focus. And I think, as you said, Maya, the Indigenous people probably have a different view of the police than everybody else does, and for good reason. So the kind of perception you're going to gain from their voices will be possibly largely negative, and it may not be the most respectful tone, but that's because of their community's experience and history with authority.
I read an article today, actually, that was telling about the sacred fire was across the police line for a little bit, and three Aboriginal police officers actually went up to the girl guarding the fire and they said, we need to get this across the police line. Like, can we help you? And so they helped her scoop up the fire and put it across the line and then helped her relight it. And I think it's also a good question to ask if the RCMP really want to be there or if it's a job.
Like a job for someone. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, are there other, like, do you feel like there maybe should be a different body that protects this kind of thing then?
like a different organization or whether it is a job for the police officers?
I'm not sure. I'd say I think for some of them it may be, but I think it would be interesting to find out where these RCMP officers stood on the ground of the case, because I mean, if they're called to duty.
Yeah, I think when it comes to protecting court injunctions, I mean, you need a legal authority. But I think, like you were saying before, and like we were all talking about, is you need to keep in context that these guys are trying to fulfill a mandate. And I guess that's what it really comes down to when you're saying that, when you're asking if a lot of them want to be there or if they're there just as a job. I do think this is a job for a lot of those. I mean, I obviously can't speak for them, but I think that they come there as authority figures, protecting an injunction that they're obliged to protect because of their mandate. And I think as long as we understand that, it's in the context of that, I think. Yeah.
Okay, and we're actually going to wrap it up there. I want to thank you guys all for coming in to share your thoughts on this very complicated topic. We're going to take a quick PSA break, and we'll be right back with the closing of the show.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Once again, students are invited to head out to Burnaby Mountain on Sunday. That's our program for today, November 28th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Alberto Montilla. Today's broadcast is produced by Marco Pradonovic. And the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. And stay tuned for Shannon right here on CITR 101.9 FM.